Hello and welcome to The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for the BP Southside, the local site for baseball prospectus covering the Chicago White Sox. My name is Nick Schaefer, and alongside me is my co-editor-in-chief, Colin Whitchurch. Hey, Colin.
What's up, Nick?
Not too much. You're back in Austin now?
I am back in Austin, where I got incredibly sunburnt last weekend at the first Texas football game of the season, and my skin is literally peeling off of my body as we speak in preparation for this Saturday when I'll just go and do it all again.
Nice. I think you know what our listeners crave, which is that peel and skin content.
Hell yeah.
just for a little bit of housekeeping, you can I imagine since you've already found the podcast, you will have success in finding again in the future. But we definitely appreciate if you want to subscribe on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast app may be. You can find it searching for The Catbird Speaks or on our Blog Talk Radio page. Or you can simply find it by going to bpsouthside.com.
And you're doing a great job hosting.
Thank you. Thank you. Trying to make sure I cover everything. I feel like I'm supposed to ask people to rate and review the podcast.
I hear that a lot, but I never have.
Which people seem to think is important, and I suppose it is.
I guess it just goes higher up on price searches. Like if you're searching baseball or White Sox, maybe it comes up higher the better it's reviewed. I don't really know how that works.
If people are searching for – say their favorite restaurant in Nashville,
yes,
it might help. the catbird seat. And that's about all I can think of. But
do you think they have a podcast?
They should, right? I mean, if they're that good of a restaurant.
Yeah. Talking about the
restaurant podcast, that's gotta be a thing.
The
already,
dish
huh?
of the day or something. Yeah. Maybe you can have a baking podcast with Giolito too.
You know what? I'd love that. I don't know why this is people who just are gregarious are labeled as, you know, great clubhouse guys and great people, personalities. And even if it's really vague and nonspecific, it's like, hey, he smiles a lot. That's fantastic. Giolito is an actual interest. You know, baking's an actual off the field hobby that isn't just watching things.
True.
So I think that's pretty neat. Speaking of which, I also think it's neat that Giolito went 7 innings, striking out 10 in his last outing. I think he allowed only one run in the process. So that is exciting. Agree or disagree?
You're not going to believe this, but I'm going to agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
I feel like we always have to take guys shoving in September kind of with a grain of salt. You know, September is just kind of this oddball. You don't know what type of lineups you're facing. I know, you know, Tampa's lineup is pretty good, but I know in James Fegan's piece over at The Athletic, he talked about how – I think he had quotes from Steven Souza Jr. who said, you know, they watched tape, they read the scouting reports, and it was nothing like that with all the changeups he was using and stuff. So, you know, I understand the reason for maybe wanting to temper your enthusiasm a little bit, but hell, it's better than the alternative, right?
Yeah, so – I think this is something similar to scouting the minor league stat line, where our prospect team will tell you that it's that the stats need to be explained, but they aren't necessarily dispositive of what's happening. But then, all things being equal, you'd just much rather have good performance than not. And Tampa, September, as you said, the rosters are diluted, but Tampa is still in the wild card race, and they pretty much ran their A lineup out there. There are two other components to Souza's comments about not being prepared for what Giolito threw, which is that, yeah, this is what's the expression? This is a game of adjustments, right? So as the league gets more of a book on Giolito, they're going to adjust to try to counter what he does well, and then he's going to have to adjust back. What's encouraging to me, though, is the reason why they were surprised by what he was doing, which is that I think he really wasn't throwing his curveball much at all, which is probably still his best pitch. He's this year added, since coming to the White Sox, he's added a slider and he's worked a lot on his changeup. And the fact that he was able to have such dominant success against a legit major league lineup by using those offerings means that they're good enough. They're major league pitches, or certainly if his control is on or his command is on for a day, which means that, you know, even if he might have 4 solid to plus pitches and that'll speak to a problem that's going to continue moving forward. Like, okay, when he faces the Rays again, what, they're going to look out more for the changeup, and then he's going to throw the curveball at him. And that's kind of a nice – it's nice to have the diversity of repertoire so that people can't sit on anything. And if on a given night you don't have great feel for one of your pitches, you could move to another one.
Yeah, it was very – I think it was an impressive display of his arsenal. I liked the idea of – I mean, that's kind of – what you see a lot of pitchers doing right now. You see it a lot with, you saw it a lot with Jose Quintana when he was kind of in his ascent about, you know, he's using his leverage to just blow his fastball past hitters with that high heat. And that's particularly important because his velocity isn't, you know, what people thought it was going to be, you know, when he was kind of ascending to that number one prospect status. But, yeah, like you said, the fact that his curveball is, like, his – that's the pitch that, you know, scouts and analysts were drooling over all those years ago. And that wasn't even the pitch he was throwing very often. That wasn't the pitch he had the best feel for. It was the changeup. It was the fastball. And, like you said, he has added a slider. And I think that's a really good sign.
Yeah, and if you can hold, you know, 92 to 95 isn't 96 to 100, obviously.
Yeah.
But – there are so for all that velocity has ramped up across baseball over the last 5 to 10 years, I think it's most dramatic in the bullpen. I still think that if you can hold 91 to 94 deep into an outing, I think that's plenty if you're doing other things well.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's, I understand that expectations and previously established notions of a player are really hard to shake. But he doesn't need to throw – if he has three usable to plus secondaries, he does, and he's still got major league average to slightly above velocity as a starter, I don't see what the problem is. I really don't.
Yeah, like it's like you said with the preconceived notions. If Giolito had been throwing with this velocity the entire time he was running through the minors, nobody would even be talking about his velocity right now. They'd just be like, yeah, he's a – you know, a really good pitching prospect who throws 92 to 95 with a plus changeup and a plus curveball. They wouldn't be saying, oh, well, why doesn't he throw 96, 97? It's just the fact that he used to do it is why people bring it up.
Yeah, and obviously there's concern about whether, you know, velocity decreases can mean other very bad things.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I think it's a general principle that pitchers – throw less and less hard as they age, unless they're Max Scherzer, I think, is the, like, I think Scherzer and Quintana are kind of outliers in that capacity. But yeah, there's nothing but positives to take out of that. I think, I also saw, gosh, I wish I could cite this properly. Saw some discussion of how Giolito was getting better extension on his pitches as well, which, especially if you're, what is he, like 6'7" or something like that? If you're gigantic, you've got longer arms, and if you're getting better extension, it effectively shortens the distance that the pitch is traveling, which effectively makes it appear faster, gives pitchers hitters less time to make a decision about the pitch, which, you know, all that's a good thing. And it's something that I think Don Cooper has done well with getting a good extension from the people he works with, which I think is a good thing as well. So those are all positive things that are improving about his profile that would easily offset any loss of velocity. You know, yeah. It's not like Tyler Colick, where it was like, this dude throws 100. Yeah. We don't know what else he does. The guy throws 100. And now that he doesn't throw 100, it's like, okay, we've got to see if he happens to also be able to do the other things. And it's, you know, we'll see what happens when he comes back from TJ.
For sure. So Giolito is someone who, I guess, in probably like June, we were kind of worried about the idea that he could be penciled in the rotation of the future. I think those concerns have been alleviated to a large extent. But I don't know if the same can be said. It's kind of been mixed reactions, I guess, a little bit with Reynaldo Lopez, who we saw on Wednesday run into a fair amount of bad luck with multiple defensive misplays behind him. But he only allowed one earned run through six innings, but he did only strike out two while walking two. It was his second start back following his brief little two-week DL stint. What, I guess, has your opinion on Lopez and his future prospects changed at all, given his four starts this year, his two starts since his return?
Not really. I think I've always been a little bit more optimistic on Lopez sticking as a starter than people who know better than I do. Which is that I know that for guys with shorter builds or deliveries that aren't the prototypical ideal delivery, the smart bet is to say those are drawbacks, and that we should bet against them. And yeah, Lopez is, you know, only 6 feet tall. Says a guy. I mean, I'm 6 feet tall, and I don't consider myself short, but for pitchers, certainly. I guess some of that's just betting on the organization, betting on the White Sox being able to get the most out of Lopez, keep him healthy, keep his mechanics as good as they're going to be. And frankly, you know, I think we have to just kind of chuck the second start. I don't like just throwing out endpoints, but like if he had a minor injury that doesn't really have any reflection on, you know, doesn't represent any concerns moving forward for his health or any damage to his throwing arm, he was just pitching hurt, and that, you know, he was pitching compromised. So, I mean, looking at the other three starts, in all three of them, he's gone six innings pretty efficiently, which if I told you that Lopez would string together multiple starts deep into games with roughly 100 pitches or less, I think that would be really, really encouraging for the fact that, you know, this is a guy, when you say he's got huge stuff and his command isn't there, it'd be really easy to see him doing, you know, posting a lot of like 3-4 inning outings where he like walks 4 or 5 guys. And yeah, sure, maybe he strikes out 8, but, you know, hitters are either fouling it off or waiting for a walk. And those outings just... Instead, we're seeing relatively efficient outings. And if the 2-2 strikeout to walk ratio for last night's game is certainly not, you know, it's not Giolito's 10 or whatever, but I think his swinging strike rate was still pretty good. Like, he was getting swings and misses. Yeah, he had nine swinging strikes, 102 pitches. And, you know, I think that's, you know, it's not the 15 in 85 pitches that he had against Tampa, but it's still an encouraging outing, especially against a Cleveland lineup that has also that is also a very real lineup at this stage of the season.
For sure. I think, like you mentioned, I guess throwing out a start is cheating a little bit, but if you do...
But there's a reason, right? Yes, it's not just like, oh, he was terrible, so I'm going to ignore it.
Exactly. And if you do that, you're looking at 18 innings, 6 earned runs, 15 strikeouts, and 6 walks. Well, it's not lighting the world on fire, but for a young pitcher, for someone making his, not major league debut, but a season debut, only his, I don't know, like 7th, 8th, and 9th career starts or whatever they are, that's something you can build on. That's something that that shows a lot of promise. And honestly, the is he a starter or a reliever debate it's gotten kind of tiresome, to be honest with you. I get it when you're like discussing prospects or you're building lists. You know, I don't blame, you know, our Baseball Prospectus prospect team for doing it, especially when they're, you know, building top midseason top 50s or top 101s, because that's their job. That's literally their job. But once they get to the major league level, once someone like Lopez gets to the point where he's at, it's like, it's almost pointless to talk about, because the White Sox are going to give him every single opportunity to prove he is a starter. We're not going to know the answer to this question for a long time. I would say maybe not even all of 2018, because he's going to start and, you know, unless he just completely flames out and is just, you know, like failing to get through 3 innings every single night, which I don't see happening. It's something that we're going to just watch and see. And if the time comes when he's not a starter anymore, then so be it. But until that point, I'm kind of over that whole debate, to be honest with you.
Sure. And I understand that some of that debate is saying, what do you think he ultimately winds up being? And you have to make an assessment based on what you think the probability distribution is. And it's not enough to say, you know, we were talking about this a little bit in the Slack. I'll use this as an analogy. Pablo Sandoval's weight. when he was going well, And people would, you know, he was playing well, and people would say, oh, well, you know, but his weight, how is he going to age? And some people would get really angrily defensive. It's like, his weight clearly doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He's able to play well with the weight. Therefore, it's not a problem. It's like, okay, but like, it might be a problem eventually. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know if his weight had anything to do with his precipitous decline at age, you know, 28. But I think it's similar to, even as a kid, I was coming, you hear about pitchers, oh, he has a rubber arm. It doesn't bother him to pitch, like to be abused, basically, or run out 3-4 days in a row, or to pitch absurd amounts of innings or high pitch counts. Like, he can handle it. Those guys, I feel like they have rubber arms until they don't. It's like, yeah, he can handle it for now, but yeah, eventually he might break down. So for Lopez, I guess the concern would either be that he can't hold his command well enough to be a starter, to go multiple times through an inning, through a lineup, or that his build and delivery will eventually lead to injury, which we can't know, right? Like, maybe,
right,
maybe in 2 years after pitching on a starter's workload, he does break down. And all those concerns will have been vindicated. But as far as performance, you know, he's holding his velocity in right between 94 and 95. And the repertoire looks pretty good. He's getting solid results right now, and that's kind of all I can, it's kind of all I can tell you for now. And then it becomes, and what's frustrating too about these discussions of, oh, well, I think he's eventually going to get injured, is with pitchers, you're probably going to be right eventually anyway.
regardless, the odds are in your favor.
Right. Regardless of whether you actually saw something or didn't, I'm sure if unless Chris Sale is like Nolan Ryan, you know, eventually he's going to get hurt in some capacity other than the mysterious truck foot thing. And someone's going to say, aha, I knew it. That delivery was bad, even though he's already pitched like 1,300 innings with like no arm injuries. So like,
I hate those things. I hate when that, it just reminds me, this is a little off topic, but it reminds me of when I was watching the 2005, Illinois basketball team that lost one game all season, made it to the national championship, and it was the same deal where there were people like, this isn't real. You know, they're gonna fall apart eventually. They're gonna fall apart eventually. They went into the national championship with one loss and lost to North Carolina, and everyone said, see, I told you that they'd fall apart eventually. It's like, they made it to the national championship game, and it's like, if Chris Sale has a 15-year career and then gets hurt, people say, see, his mechanics. I told you they were gonna break down eventually. It's like, motherfucker, he had a 15-year, he had a Hall of Fame career.
Yeah,
that's not what that the Illinois, conversation that, was about.
In my opinion, that Illinois team got, I watched that finals. I'm pretty sure they got hosed by the refs that game as well.
Sean May.
And yeah, and if you want to say, you know, well, was it a fluke or not? I told you North Carolina would win. That Illinois team produced much better pros than that Carolina team did.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Like McCants didn't do anything.
Sean May didn't do anything.
I guess Lawson, I guess. Or Felton, rather. Yeah, Felton had a solid career, but I think Williams was better. And I think didn't Luther Head like do some stuff in the pros for a minute?
Yeah, for a minute with the Rockets. I remember that game was on the same day as the season opener of the 2005 White Sox, which I attended. I saw Mark Burley throw a 1-0 shutout against the Indians in what?
Is that against Kevin Miller?
I couldn't tell you who the opposing pitcher was. I saw my favorite team begin what ended up being a World Series championship season, and then went home and watched my favorite college basketball team lose in a national championship game on the same day. That's something that I always remember randomly.
The opening day win probably didn't mean as much to you as the championship loss, but
no, not at the time.
Oh, it was Jake Westbrook.
Oh, Jake Westbrook. Yeah, I should have known that. It was 1-0 though. I remember that.
It was. Takatsu closed that game.
That's World Series champion Shingo Takatsu. I mean, I'm sure they gave him a ring, right? They had to have.
I'd imagine so. Don't you know,
anyone who
they're pretty generous with those rings, right? Typically, most organizations.
I mean, Rick Renteria got a Cubs World Series ring, so yes, I think they're pretty generous.
Oh, I should have asked. You know what? I blew it, because that would have been the best trivia question. I would say, who got the save for the White Sox in that game? That might have been a tough question.
I would have gotten that.
Really? Okay.
I might have said Dustin Hermanson first, but I would have gotten to Takatsu. I forget that Hermanson took over and then it was Jenks. That's something that always trips me up on occasion.
That was a I mean, it's easy to because like Jenks was the most visible during the most important times, but
yeah,
there were a bunch of dudes who got saves on that team. Can you so Hermanson got 34, Takatsu at 8, Jenks at 6. Can you name the three other relievers who got saves for that for the 2005 White Sox?
Well, Cliff Polite has to be one of them.
He got one.
Neil Kotz
did not.
Damaso Marte.
He got four.
All right. So I'm missing one.
Yeah, that's I'm incredibly impressed already.
man.
Because by the end of the year, Marte was bumped down a couple rungs in the bullpen because of how well Polite, Kotz, and Jenks were pitching.
Yeah, I just remember Marte having to pitch at least one and maybe two innings in that Game 3 marathon against the Astros and being terrified. He may have even gotten the win in that.
He was so good. So great.
Okay.
He got another World Series of the Yankees, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, 2009.
Yeah, I think you're right. The other save was... shit. There are people screaming at their radio or whatever and saying who it is.
I'll tell you, it wasn't Jeff Baggianero.
Well, I feel like there's someone that I can
picture. Iconic?
Iconic. Well, you're talking playoffs too, then Burley.
No. Oh. This is just regular season.
Iconic. I don't know. I'm going to have to give up because this is probably getting to boring radio.
It was El Duque.
El Duque. Oh, man.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Was iconic an unfair clue?
That was a good clue. I was trying to think of some like rando who wasn't on the team for very long or something like that.
I thought iconic would steer you away from the John Adkinsons of the world, but
the mistake that we've made here is anytime there's some reference made to the 2005 White Sox, we could just do an entire podcast just saying, "Remember when this happened?" That was awesome.
Well, I don't even know if the thing is my brain starts releasing serotonin so fast when 2005 White Sox comes up. So it's like, I don't know, is that even that bad a thing? If any other, no. You know, I presumably our audience is White Sox fans. So.
The thing that I'm always hesitant about is my opinion's a little skewed because I'm not a Bears fan. But I got to the point, especially growing up,
two Packers fans running this.
Yeah, but people, I always roll my eyes when references are made to the 85 Bears. It's like, well, the 85 Bears this, well, the 85 Bears that. And it's, you know, it's been fucking 32 years. And now here we are 12 years later saying, well, the 05 White Sox this and the 05 White Sox this. And I was like, I don't want to sound like that. That's obnoxious. They need to get back before we turn into a new version of 85 Bears fans.
Hey, there is peril in that. Maybe it's because I'm a baseball guy. I do consider a World Series win so much more significant than a Super Bowl win.
Well, also, we've seen two Packers Super Bowl wins, so maybe we're a little jaded.
Maybe. It's just, like, I would, you know, trade both of those for another White Sox World Series in a heartbeat.
We're going to lose so many listeners and followers by admitting that we're both Packers on this podcast.
I know. So my grandpa grew up in Green Bay and played high school football. His coach was Curly Lambeau when he was playing high school.
That's pretty
cool, I guess. So even though he was born on the site, I think my grandpa was born it was across the street from Old Comiskey, and I think that's now where the park currently sits.
Yes.
So, you know, a conflicted man as far as that goes. But,
Oh, by the way, Luis Vizcaino was the guy I was going to guess whose name I couldn't remember for another save.
He was pretty good.
He was.
Pretty good. I mean, like, the fact that he was the last guy out of the bullpen for them for that playoff team was nuts. Like, a guy that good was your seventh reliever or whatever at that point. It was crazy, but that team was good. So
I was right, by the way. Damaso Marte did get the win in Game 3 of the World Series.
Nice. Good call. So despite having traded Miguel Gonzalez and not, you know, really having – Gonzalez was the best guy in the rotation after Rodon, I guess, until, you know, Giolito and Lopez are certainly better than, have been better than what they've been running out for that, like, month in between them calling up and everybody getting traded. But Derek Holland still could not retain a spot in this staff, unfortunately, and was released. I think it, you know, this, the team wound up rolling Holmberg out for a start subsequently, which I think kind of says a lot about where Holland was at, that he couldn't, that he couldn't stick around anyway, you know, that they just couldn't keep running him out there. You know, they tried him in relief. He was just throwing batting practice for months.
Yeah, I think the way you wrote it was pretty perfect, where you listed the, I should have had the article up when I started the sentence, but you listed his splits after his first start, sixth start to the season. Oh yeah. His last 100 innings, he's allowed opposing batters to hit 322, 417, 595, which is better than Mike Trout's career split.
Yeah.
Everybody who's faced Derek Holland for the last 100 innings has been better than Mike Trout. I think that's the best way to sum it up, I think. But part of me's like, I mean, what benefit is there of to cutting him with 25, 30 games left in the season, especially if his spot isn't being taken up by, like, another prospect that they want to call up? It's like, if your starts are going to David Holmberg, it's like, I don't know. I don't really care one way or the other, honestly, because, you know, nothing matters as far as results go to the end of the season. It's just kind of weird where it's like, well, why not just let him play out the rest of the season unless he wants to, you know, go relax and watch college football. Maybe he wanted to be released if he wasn't going to start.
I think, you know, maybe they sat down with Holland because there clearly weren't, I don't think there was, I think Holland posted some stuff that indicated, you know, there's no bad blood. I don't think he was offended.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean it that way. I just,
or insulted like, by it. Well, no, totally. I think what I'm driving at is, you know, perhaps he sat down with the organization and they were saying, look, you know, you made it through the season healthy. You know, take, maybe it's best for your career if you take the winner and, you know, maybe prep for next season as a reliever or something like that. And don't get injured trying to, you know, if you're fatigued, this is the most he's thrown in forever. You know, maybe don't go hurt yourself. Maybe it was just best for everybody. I guess it's hard to read that. I mean, who knows what's going on with him? Maybe he is just, maybe he retires. Who knows? But you know, crazier things have happened. I mean, like Oliver Perez is still pitching in the majors. Like Joe Blanton morphed into an Uber reliever for a year or two. Like weird stuff happens. So especially when it comes to relievers. So like, you know, I wouldn't count him out.
Man, Oliver Perez is still pitching in the majors.
Do you know that Matt Albers is like having an amazing year?
Yeah. But
like, that makes no sense.
Guess who the only one in the world is who's not shocked by that? The world's biggest Matt Albers fan right here. No doubt that he was going to have a bounce back season this year. He's you know, he's a beast. He's got a 1.71 ERA and 52 innings for the Nats.
He is striking out 9.9 per nine, which is the best of his career. And he's been above what is it? The second best for a full season was he was striking out 9.5 per nine back in 2011. And other than that, I don't think he's ever been above, 7.2 is his next best.
8.1. Well, that was, you're right. Never mind.
That wasn't a full season.
well, neither was a 7.2. That was in 10 innings.
Jeez.
Well, anyway, I guess the point of you bringing that up is, and which is what I 100% agree with, is that they should have kept him. They should have brought him back, and then they probably could have flipped him for Victor Robles or something. So, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Missed opportunity by the White Sox.
They clearly just didn't give Albers enough chances. So, young guy like that, upside like that, cut bait. Yeah, it's a bummer. I guess it frees up room for, you know, younger guys to soak up some of those innings. Yeah. Although I think they're done with September call-ups other than maybe, you know, Willie Garcia when he comes back off the DL. That's not really a call-up. I think I saw James tweeting about he saw like Soto throwing a little bit, Giovanni Soto throwing a little bit. So who knows?
Yeah,
maybe he
saw
gets...
that too.
I think they still have the Holland release. I don't think it's because they needed room on the 40 man either. I think they had plenty of space.
Yeah, I think they're at like 38 or something like that.
So you know, if they wanted to activate Soto,
Tilson. Where's Charlie Tilson at?
They took him to a nice farm upstate. get to run around. He'll be happier there. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about Charlie Tilson. It's. I'm so bummed for him. That's so. Got to be so frustrating.
Yeah. At least Ryan doesn't have to chug a gallon of milk.
Oh yeah. What was the wager again?
I think it was just that if he played 20 games, Ryan said he would chug a gallon of milk.
Is that for his whole career?
No, I think it was just this season.
Oh, at what point? That becomes mathematically impossible soon.
Well, yeah. I want to dig this tweet up.
There aren't as many. I think so. You know, other than you know, Moncada and Delmonico are back off the DL. Although Delmonico got a little shook up diving for a ball last night. So I think that we're pretty much we've got the prospects we're gonna see. Yes. They're here. We're not really going to see anyone else. The main of the year, Jace Fry got called up. He's more of a fringe guy. He's, you know,
nice
potential. Yeah, definitely rooting for him. He's had two Tommy John surgeries, as I wrote about, and they seem to have this year marked, I guess, the second Tommy John killed his hopes of being a starter. That doesn't mean he can't be a solid lefty reliever. This is a world where Dan Jennings got you somebody good back and was a useful piece for a while. So, Fry could definitely live in that space in a bullpen, not necessarily a loogie, but not really not Andrew Miller either. And, other than that, it's guys like, post prospects like Reimer Liriano going to get some plate appearances. Our buddy Rob Brantley is back and, killing it.
Why is he our buddy?
Oh, he was super nice to my cousin's kids at spring training.
That's right. I remember you saying that.
And he had that hilarious he caught that walk-off in the bullpen a few years ago from – I think it was Abreu.
I don't remember that.
Oh, I thought you were a White Sox fan. My mistake. So, yeah, it's going to be Moncada, the two starting pitchers, and to an extent, I guess, Delmonico and – That's kind of what to watch for.
I mean, Tim and Abreu are guys who are enjoyable to watch during an otherwise lost season. Well, Tim Anderson, I guess we didn't really have Tim Anderson on the agenda, but he's still been on the hot streak that he's been on, huh?
Yeah, I'd have to. I could pull up his recent splits. He has a cold, as James Talese wrote.
But yeah,
he's certainly – let's see. His low point for OPS this season came on August 1st. He was at 601.
Since August 1st, he's at 825 OPS.
Yeah, there you go. It's a very Tim Anderson,
.825.
Yeah, 282 batting average, .527 slugging, and let's not talk about the OBP sort of thing. But, if that's the type of player he is, if he's hitting .280 with power, that's an awesome player.
It's a very valuable middle infielder, yes.
Yeah, totally. A lot to keep an eye on the day-to-day of Moncada's batting average, I guess. Because I don't know that there's much else to say about Moncada. It's just depending on where the batting average lands is going to dictate whether he's – given the patience and power he's shown and speed – it's a difference between him being a solid to slightly above average regular if he's hitting, 230, 240, to potentially being the superstar that he could be if he hits 280 or even 260, 270. So it's that's going to be interesting to monitor, although obviously the fluctuations of batting average over the course of a few weeks shouldn't really make you feel too strongly one way or the other as far as what his future holds. And, we saw how much of an improvement how much he's improved from this time last year to now, which I think should be really encouraging.
Yeah.
The fact that he got absolutely stomped in the majors last year, like really, really was overmatched. Got sent down to AAA, put the work in, improved at that level, and now came up, and he's got a 323 on base percentage, and he's got a great ISO. It's just a matter of how many balls are going to fall in play, and he doesn't need to make amazing contact all the time to get some base. I mean, he's a guy who should be getting some infield hits, and he should be getting some extra bases on some hits that he otherwise wouldn't because he is a burner. So something to keep an eye on moving forward, though, for sure.
Yeah, and like you said, regardless of how tuned in I am to a particular White Sox game, I still am trying to tune in for the Moncada at-bats, and I'm going to watch a lot more closely when Lopez or Giolito's on the mound. And it's, you know, just from a selfish personal standpoint of enjoying to watch baseball, that those things – I was actually having a conversation yesterday with a buddy about he was watching the Indians. He was like, I'm going to watch the Indians really closely this year. They're really good. You know, they're on this big winning streak. And then he was giving me a hard time. He's like, it sucks that I decided this when you're there playing your White Sox because the White Sox suck. And I'm like, oh, yeah, haha, good joke. But also it made me think of watching the White Sox in September this year, way more fun than watching the White Sox in September last year or the year before that. Because – they actually still have some fun players worth watching, and they're not just veterans going through the motions. So that's
a nice thing. And it's going somewhere, right?
Yes.
Like, even last year, it was nice that Abreu finished strong, but it didn't, like, tell me anything new about him at all. It wasn't new information. If Giolito finishing the year really strong is new information, especially it's like, hey, and this kind of – I know we typically say reader questions for the end. We did have a question this week, which kind of – while I'm – we kind of addressed this already, but it comes from HawksFan314. Why does Lucas Giolito look so good? Velo isn't back to high 90s. Is it just catching hitters unaware? Is change more plus than we realize? So, I think we talked a little bit about this at the top of the episode. But if the change – I mean, the changeup was always – even when he was throwing 100 – the changeup was always a work in progress, right? And he's still a young pitcher who's and change is a field pitch. So if he's improved his changeup this year, that wouldn't be surprising at all. And he threw it. I think he's thrown about 25% of the time in his last couple outings, and he's gotten really good results with it. So, if he's added that as a genuine weapon, that would go a long way to explaining why he's succeeding right now. And having that to watch at the end of a season is so much more fun than whatever the last 4 years have been.
Yeah. And I think like we touched on a little bit, I think the big key with, especially with pitches like the changeup, which are new and developing and kind of a different weapon for him, is to see how he fares with it once teams have it on tape, which they do now. They have one start of it, at least, of it doing what it did, on Friday or Saturday, whatever day he started last week. So that'll be interesting. But, I mean, just because a team has tape on a guy doesn't guarantee that they're going to get better results. I mean, if that were the case, then no pitcher would ever have a successful 10-year career.
I've got tape on Sale's slider.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anybody can hit it.
Exactly. So that'll be interesting to watch going forward. I think that, the fact that I don't have it in front of me, but I think the velocity difference between that changeup and the fastball was a good 10 miles an hour or so, was it not? And that's...
Yeah, I could pull it up right now. Not right now. I'm working on it. it's 10, pretty much 10 miles per hour on the nose.
Yeah. So
great separation. I can't speak to how the arm action looks from the hitter's perspective, but the results kind of indicate how it was going.
It's not that dissimilar to how we've viewed Carlos Rodon, who I'd be remiss to not mention when we were listing off all of the reasons that the Sox are still watching.
Sure.
We haven't even brought up Rodon, but it's kind of the same deal where when he came up, it's like, okay, well, he's got this this fastball that he throws 93, 94, and he's got this awesome, some say 80 grade wipeout slider, and then this changeup that's developing. And, you know, everyone pretty much agrees that if he starts commanding his fastball and really refining the changeup to make it above average pitch, that, you know, watch out, Carlos Rodon's going to be a fucking world eater. And it's kind of the same thing with Giolito, where it's like, all right, command your fastball. You've got this curveball that everyone drools over. Now let's get this changeup up to speed also. So it's not that dissimilar. I think, you know, Rodon's farther along in his development, obviously, but same deal with Giolito.
Yeah, and it's, you know, granted, it's easy to just say, yeah, if he gets his fastball command there, you know, he could be great. It's sure. Yeah, well, you know, if everybody, you know, Cliff Lee was only still throwing like 91 and 93 when he got his morphed into 80 grade fastball command, and we all saw what happened.
Yeah.
For sure. And it's easy to forget. You've done that twice now. You reminded us that Rodon and Anderson are still they're not prospects anymore, but they function similarly in terms of a viewer's experience. So a lot of fun stuff to watch as they play out the string results wise. But that's, hey, you know, that's what we signed up for coming into the season. And I guess I'd have to go through and see if I would consider like the development of most players in the system a success or I mean, Fulmer is the biggest disappointment, but
yeah, at least in recent years. Started. I mean, we could go back to, you know, the Courtney Hawkinses and Jared Mitchells of the world, but who wants to do that? I did want to. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of reader questions, but so I did want to pose a question to you, Nick, that was posed to me in my chat on baseballperspectives.com yesterday, and kind of get your opinion about, you know, we've talked about all the prospects and, you know, guys who have been good, and just I don't feel like there are a lot of guys who we had high expectations for coming into this season who have disappointed. I guess Fulmer would be maybe one from a prospect level, but is there anyone who you thought would work out this year that hasn't?
I guess it's hard to say thought would work. I mean, Anderson's been disappointing for sure. Was it supposed to be limited just to prospects?
No, this is actually a question from someone with the username Jay Fegan, and I'll just pose you the question in the exact way he did. He said, in the wake of Derek Holland getting released, who is a guy you really thought would work out this year but hasn't? And then he said, or vice versa, which I didn't read when I answered the question, because I think the answer to that is obviously Avi, but who?
Yeah, I didn't think Avi would work out. Certainly not this well. I didn't think Swarzak would do what he did either. By the way, Swarzak, according to Baseball Reference, is still fourth on this team in wins above replacement, despite having been traded away and being a reliever. So, you know, Anderson's year has certainly been disappointing, though certainly foreseeable. Like this was what it would look like if, you know, he had some growing pains. This is pretty obvious. Other big disappointments. I mean, Petrichka just got put back on the DL, which I guess like the injured pitchers, Putnam, Jones, Petrichka, those are all guys who, you know, have shown they can be really effective to varying degrees. I mean, Jones and Putnam have been elite when they've been on the mound in recent years. And now all three of them, I think you just have to classify. You like can't count on them to do anything moving forward, just because they've all been injured so much, which has definitely been a negative for this season. Rodon's injury, I guess, is another one.
Yeah.
To that in that bucket. In terms of just like raw performance being like really underwhelming, I can't really. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe my expectations were high. Do you have somebody to throw out there?
Yeah, my answer, and I think the reason maybe you didn't think of him is because either your expectations were really low or you just haven't thought of him all season, which I haven't, is Tyler Saladino.
Yeah.
And that's again an injury thing, but like what I wrote yesterday is that going into the season, they had this glut of kind of fringe major leaguer middle infielders in like Saladino and Yulmer and Leury. And Saladino's been the worst by far.
Right, which isn't what you would have guessed coming into this year.
Yeah, I mean, Saladino was a you know, he was an above replacement level player in 2016. He was a guy who went into the season
good.
And you're like, all right, this guy's going to be, you know, a major league utility player for a while. He's, you know, he's not going to be a superstar. He's not going to be an all-star, but he's a valuable player. He's someone that the White Sox developed, you know, a position player that they developed, and that's unheard of. And this year, and maybe you can blame it on the injury to a certain extent, he's only had, you know, he's only played in 65 games, but he just hasn't done anything. You know, this guy was he not like the leadoff hitter on opening day this season? Or
something like that. No, totally. I mean, he was definitely ahead of those guys. He, you know, was somebody that I imagine would have been the first to take anyone's job if they got hurt, if he had been healthy. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really fair choice for the terms of that question.
And he's not important, you know, to the future of the White Sox. You know, he's 28 years old. People think he's a little younger than that because it's only his third year in the majors. But this isn't a young player, and it's not a player with a really high ceiling, but it's someone who, you know, I kind of thought, like, oh, you know, the White Sox get good 2019, 2020, he'll kind of still be hanging around as someone who can fill in at those three infield positions and, you know, maybe even, like, left field or something. And now, you know, that's Leury, and that's Yolmer, and, you know, that's fine. You know, whoever it is, it's totally fine. It just was more surprising to me than anything.
Totally. And there are other guys who've certainly been disappointing at the major league level in terms of, like, you know, Jacob May, but like, I didn't think Jacob May was gonna, I was confused when he won the job.
Yeah.
For example, Cody Ashe, like, I didn't really expect much from him. I guess I expected more than that. So there've been disappointments, but clearly the positive surprises have outweighed them by a lot.
Which is funny for a team that's 30 games under 500.
I know, right? Right. Hey, you know, their Pythag is, they should have 57 wins, not 54.
Oh, man. I'm on 100 loss watch right now. I think they need to go 8-15. I think they need to go to avoid 100 losses this season.
Okay.
So
I'd like them to avoid 100 losses.
For sure.
I think that's a point of pride. And no, I don't care about them tanking for the number one pick. I really don't. Also, Victor Robles is getting called up, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
Didn't he start the season like high A?
Sounds right. I think, I guess it could just be as simple as like his minor league season's over and this will just get him more reps. And they think he's close enough to ready that it won't mess him up.
He's 20 years old. He started the year in A+ and then went to AA. He's been in AA for 158 plate appearances and now he's going to the majors.
Yeah, that's nuts. I mean, he annihilated AA.
He did.
And he's a burner and he's a plus defensive outfielder. So like with these expanded rosters in the National League, it makes a ton of sense. Use him as even if you just want to use him as a defensive replacement and pinch runner or as a pinch hitter, like, you know, why not? And get him a look, let him get his bearings. I mean, it's a lot less. This is about where Moncada was at when the Red Sox called him up last year
to be
the everyday third baseman on a team that was like trying to make the playoffs as opposed to a team that's clinched and he can just kind of like, you know, get some at bats and blowout wins or games that don't really matter. So it totally makes sense. It just surprised me.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been something I predicted.
That is surprising to me too. By the way, quick aside,
I did pick him up in fantasy in case he goes in case he goes Devers on everybody.
I missed my playoffs, so I'm depressed. Let's not talk about fantasy baseball.
Oh, I got a bye week.
Last time the White Sox lost 100 games in a season, by the way, 1970.
Wow.
I know they lost 99 4 years ago. But yeah, 1970 White Sox went where'd it go? 56-106. With Tommy John as their most valuable player. So
nice.
There you go.
So
Bill Melton, Luis Aparicio, a 36-year-old Luis Aparicio, a very young Carlos May, Tommy John and a bunch of guys I've never heard of. Oh, Wilbur Wood was the closer for that team.
The next year was when Joe Horland too. Wow, okay. Obviously age is a big deal here, but there's some names on here where I wouldn't have guessed this for a 100 loss team.
Yeah.
I really
Walt Williams, I mean,
Like, their catcher OPS 862. Like, that's not normally on 100 loss teams. Yeah, they had some, like, above-average bats. I mean, was the rotation just horrible? I guess, yeah. Joe Horland is a guy who had some crazy good years.
I don't remember Joe Horland. I'm not familiar.
67 Joe Horland was, like, is a if he finished second in Cy Young awards. If you ever want to play What If Sports, that's, like, he's got a couple of seasons that are just, like, unreal good. Wilbur Wood the next year would go from the closer to pitching 334 innings of sub-2 ERA ball, which was a little light for him. He threw 376 innings the next year, but not quite as good.
I think this is my favorite side tangent we've ever gone on. They had three managers that year, too. Don Gutter,
was that when,
Gutteridge, Bill Adair, and Chuck Tanner.
Oh, so did Larry Doby replace Chuck Tanner at one point later?
That sounds
right. Is that the guy he replaced?
Their GM also got fired that year, too.
Oh, yeah, it says fired 19. Jeez. Okay, so, but yeah, like, some names on that team. Like, if you told me, like, Wilbur Wood and Joe Horland and Tommy John would all be on a 100-loss team together, that's, I'd be like, what, were they, like, 50? What was going on?
Yeah,
but, right. I think that's, I mean, I feel pretty on top of it for the White Sox. I don't know if there was any other things you wanted to add before we zoomed out a little bit.
No, let's talk shit about the AL Central.
Okay, well, so the Tigers made a couple of trades. They traded Justin Verlander to Houston, which was funny because everyone was, like, screaming at me and saying, like, Houston will never trade their prospects. They will never trade their prospects. And I was like, hey, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, although clearly they were willing to. And B, my argument was that they should. So clearly, if you think that front office is perfect, they clearly agree with me because they should, and they did. So they added Verlander. They'll have him. He's not a rental. They'll have him for two more years after this. And I think with the salary balance, it's about 2 years, 20 mil per season to the Astros, which, you know, good. Like, you should spend some money to support this team, this roster as it stands. I think that name will carry a lot of value with the clubhouse because there was some rumblings that they were underwhelmed at Francisco Liriano, and that's it as their deadline acquisitions. So this should help. What are your thoughts on this one?
I mean, I think it definitely makes sense from – this is a boring opinion. It makes sense for both teams. You know, we've been screaming about the Astros, especially when all the Quintana rumors were happening, about how they need to go for it. You know, this is your World Series window. Take advantage of it. You know, maybe Daz Cameron will become a superstar in 6 years, but if you win a World Series in 2017, then who gives a shit? You know, that's the same argument that we were making to Cubs fans about Gleyber Torres a year ago, and they won the World Series. So who gives a shit? If he's good?
Well, my argument about, the Gleyber Torres example is a bad one, I think. Because there was other stuff going on there.
Sure, like, just from a baseball
perspective. You're right, like, and that's the defense of it now, but, like, I do think other relievers could have done as well as Chapman wound up doing for the Cubs.
Yeah.
And he nearly blew the World Series for them anyway.
That's true.
And Torres was such a huge price to pay for it, but I didn't mean to, like, I get it. You're right, though. It's like, you know, who cares about it's like that, I can't even remember this, even an old Family Guy joke or something like that, where it's like, do you take, like, the speedboat or what's in the mystery box? It's like, well, sure, the speedboat's a speedboat, but why don't we take the mystery box? That could be anything, even a speedboat. And it's like...
Isn't that a Simpsons joke?
Maybe, yeah, something like that. I'm stealing it from somewhere, but I think it's sort of the point I was trying to make. And I'm kind of surprised. I mean, it's not like, you know, he's young and he's already in the majors, but it's not like Francis Martes is like... And Joe Musgrove have torn things up since they were not, you know, the Astros refused to part with them for Quintana. And so I guess it's how it really comes down to Kyle Tucker in terms of evaluating that. But, like, you tanked for like, you lost 100 games in a row for 3 years in a row to get here.
And for the Tigers, it's, you know, it's finally them starting down this Phillies-esque, Astros-esque, Cubs-esque path of things have to get worse to get better. Like, they've got all this dead money. They have, you know, all these aging stars. They have zero farm system. Let's restart. And, you know, I mentioned a couple podcasts ago about the bet I had with my buddy about who makes the playoffs next, the White Sox or the Tigers. I'm feeling a lot better about that bet today. But I'm also feeling like, you know, the Tigers have kind of been in this, you know, hellish financial, you know, whatever you want to call it, based on the decisions of their late owner, who desperately, and who can blame him, wanted to win a World Series. I find no fault in that logic, at least from a personal standpoint, if you are that person. But now, you know, things didn't work out, and now it's time to unload some of that money and rebuild. And now they have, you know, they have Candelario from the Cubs, who they got from Justin Wilson, who some people really like. They've got these new three guys from the Astros. I think the catcher they got, even Jake Rogers, I think is his name. I believe Eric Longerhagen called him the best defensive catcher I've ever seen in the minor leagues. So, obviously. What? Sorry.
I was just saying, Longerhagen, you know, knows what he's talking about. Yes. And Perez, yeah, you were saying, obviously, I think Franklin Perez is considered the prize of that
for sure.
Package. And he's probably a top 100 guy. I don't know where he'll land. But yeah, I mean, to the Tigers' credit, they did the year, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago when they had a random, like, really down year, they did sell off. You know, they sold
Price.
I have partial season of Cespedes for Michael Fulmer. They traded Price. So they did, you know, they've been decisive when. Yeah.
They've done these partial reloads, these kind of, yeah, partial sell-offs of impending free agents. Yeah, that sure, yeah. They have done that. But it's not like they're going in.
He had an extra year on his deal, I think.
Did but they?
Maybe not. I may be thinking of anyway, there have been too many prize trades for me to keep track of. But I mean, Miguel Cabrera is still owed, I think, like $180-something million through 2023, and he's
been terrible this year.
Yeah, and
fighting, you know, with Austin Romine, and yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see. But this is definitely, yeah, like you said, it makes sense for both teams. I'm kind of surprised at how much they got for Verlander.
Me too.
Because, you know, how much money Verlander's owed, his age, his, you know, he's not, you know, I guess last year he went back to being Cy Young caliber pitcher, but he has, you know, he's been trending closer to league average as the years have gone on.
Yeah, he's gone back and forth, and like the last couple of years between like ace and not an ace, and ace and not an ace, but
because his DRA this year is 3.51, yeah, which is good, but nothing.
But he started out terribly and has been really good, you know, the last 2 or 3 months. So it's a really weird thing where it's kind of – it's fluctuated between great and bad with Verlander. But at $20 million a year for another 2 years, and if you're trying to win the World Series in 2017, it's not something that I'm going to quibble with if I were an Astros fan.
No, and it fits their biggest need. And, he fits with their window for the next 2 years as well. And even if he's more of a mid-rotation guy, he's so durable that an organization that's had a really good success of getting guys who are really effective but can't really go more than 120, 140 innings, really. I mean, you know, McCullers and Morton and,
sure,
and maybe Peacock. You know, these are guys who, you know, they get outs when they're out there, but they're not guys you can just bank on 180 innings from them. So it kind of fits in that sense as well, where it's like, okay, well, Keuchel and Verlander are going to soak up probably 200 innings apiece, and then we can hopefully just get these guys geared up to, you know, shut down players in the postseason.
Are you worried about how this is going to affect Houston's dollar per WAR, though? I think that's a real concern.
I think it's a huge loss in that respect. I think they're I mean, because if you put Daz Cameron in the majors right now and only use him as a defensive replacement, his FRAA would probably be pretty good. And then he'd have like 0.5 wins above replacement in 20 at bats for, like, you know, the league minimum, which is way better than spending a lot on a good pitcher.
I'm so happy I did that.
I'm very concerned. But yeah, it's a bummer that, like, I don't like seeing the Tigers make good moves, but yeah, good for them.
The rest of the division, Cleveland does obviously run away with it. They actually, last night against the White Sox, they passed the struggling Dodgers for best run differential in all of baseball, which is kind of crazy.
When did they get to plus 190? When did that happen?
Well, sometime probably during this 14-game winning streak that they're currently on.
even if you win those games by, like, you know, 4 runs a game, which is a lot, like, that still only gets you part of the way there. But anyway.
Yeah. The Royals and Twins are both kind of treading water and seeming a lot better than they actually are because they're both in heat of the wild card race, the Twins more so than the Royals. What do you think of them? Open-ended question.
I mean, it's crazy because the Royals spent like a week where they didn't score any runs. They got shut out for like 4 straight games or something. They're at 500. They're 69-69.
Nice.
And they're 2.5. They're still only 2.5 games back somehow. But they look – you know what's funny is – a lot of these teams, it's like, oh, they went on a hot streak, and now they're like, they've launched themselves into contention. I think a lot of it is lined up with like when they played the White Sox. like the Twins went on this. It's like, oh my god, the Twins went on this like this run. It's like, yeah, they beat the White Sox a lot. And like the same with the Royals. The Indians obviously haven't played all 14 of their last games against the White Sox, but they played a few. So that's part of it. I mean, I've been pretty upfront about thinking the Twins are garbage all year. Their rotation is bad. Their bullpen is bad. Their front office sold at the deadline. Like, they still have a negative run differential. It's exciting. You know, like, if I'm a Twins fan, I'd be fired up about Buxton finally looking like he might not just be like the John McDonald of center fielders or whatever. And, you know, Max Kepler I've always been a fan of his. But I just – look, anything can happen. We're talking about a few weeks. I think the Twins' schedule is pretty – I think the Twins and Royals play each other a decent amount down the stretch. You know, they've got a soft-ish schedule. So the Twins could still pull this out. Hell, the Royals could still pull it out. But I just don't think they're as good as the Angels now. I mean, the Angels added Justin Upton, who replaces like Ben Revere or something, which is just like a massive upgrade.
Yeah, their left field and second base situations were like the most dreadful in baseball, and then they got Justin Upton and Brandon Phillips to fill those spots.
Yeah, and also Brandon Phillips has like, you know, it's easy. It's like, oh, he's declining, and Cincinnati then fell off the planet. And I'm guilty of this certainly, so I assume other people did this. I assume Phillips had continued to decline. He's basically, good. Yeah, he's been like a. Probably like a league average second baseman for like 3-4 years. So he's been posting the same season over and over again. So, you know, these are the positions that killed the White Sox year in, year out, and they've actually replaced them with like Justin Upton and Brandon Phillips instead of James Shields. So they're looking good. I mean, the rotation's like being held together with duct tape, but the bullpen is great for some reason. And, you know, Skaggs is back. They got Andrew Heaney back. They got – I think Garrett Richards is coming back. I don't know, man. If you just show me these two rosters right now, I feel like the Angels have a better team than the Twins or Royals do as it stands right now.
I think so. I still think – I think my money at this point would be on the Yankees and Angels winning the wild card spot. I still am baffled by the Orioles. You know, everything that you said about Minnesota's rotation, you could pretty much say about Baltimore's rotation. And their run differential is actually worse than Minnesota's. And, you know, worse than everyone within spitting distance of the wild card spot, except for Seattle and Kansas City. And only 2 runs worse than Seattle. But anyway, it's tough to fathom this. I mean, I think LA is the best team on paper of these one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight teams that are still in the wild card race, if you include the Yankees.
I guess the Rangers, too,
I mean, the Rangers have the best run differential, but are they the best team right now?
I mean, they traded Darvish,
exactly.
Him with Miguel Gonzalez, and I love Miguel Gonzalez, but he's not Yu Darvish, so.
He's not. I don't know. Who would you – what do we got, 3 weeks left? Who are your AL wildcard teams?
I mean, the Orioles, it's the same kind of thing as the Angels, right? Where, like you said, and the Royals – all these teams have, like, ghastly rotations, but the Orioles and Angels have really good bullpens. Like, the Orioles, again, it's the same formula. Like, guys who mash a bunch of dingers and, like, really good bullpen. The Twins arguably have – the two best starters out of those three teams, because like Ervin Santana and Berrios are like pretty good, and that's, I mean, depending on where Garrett Richards is at, that's better.
Berrios's home road splits this year are baffling.
Do you think it's just noise?
I think it's probably just noise, but it's still like it's weird. Let me bring that up real quick.
You know, the Rangers are without Beltre moving forward, but they just slide Gallo over, so maybe they'll be okay.
Are they without Beltre? I think I missed that.
He just went back on the DL. Yeah,
he has the innings total is almost identical, but Berrios is 60 innings at home with a 2.54 ERA, 63 strikeouts and 12 walks. Away, he's at 63 innings, so three more, with a 5.43 ERA, 59 strikeouts, and 24 walks, and 11 homers allowed compared to three at home. I know Minnesota is a pitcher's park.
I think less so than its initial reputation.
I think so, too, because the outfield's really big. I think it's not a home run park, but I think it's not quite as much of a pitcher's park as we had thought. Still, that's drastic. I noticed that because I went to when I was back home, I went to the White Sox Twins game that was Derek Holland versus Jose Berrios, and they flashed that on the scoreboard, and the White Sox, went on to beat him in a game that Derek Holland started. So, I still like him a lot. Like, I think he's, you know, the best pitching prospect the Twins have had since probably Liriano.
I agree.
But I don't know if he's a guy who's going to put you over the top in a playoff race this year. He's still 23. He actually turned 23 this season.
I mean, they're running Colon out there. They're running, like, I thought it was kind of, I was almost insulted that they didn't trade for Miguel Gonzalez. I'm like, what are you guys doing? But,
right.
Because I'm pretty sure they could have matched Taquan Forbes.
Maybe not in name.
All right. So logically, I think it should be – I mean, I haven't looked at all their schedules down the stretch. Logically, I think it should be the Yankees and Angels. So I'm going to predict Royals-Rays because
– What about the Mariners?
No. They can't.
By the way, Bartolo Colon has made 10 starts with the Twins and has a 3.94 ERA. So he's been pretty good.
Because Buxton catches all the, like, screaming line drives to the outfield.
Yeah. He's allowed 12 home runs and in 61 innings. But
you can – you know what? That's probably a result. You look at his peripherals. He lowered his – you know, his FIP with the Braves was 5.07. With the Twins, it's 4.97. You know, that's 10 hundredths of a point better.
The Twins are my favorite team to talk about outside of the White Sox. Just because nothing that happens there makes sense. It's like, aren't the Twins still without Sano too?
I couldn't even tell you.
I feel like he's he was out when they came to Chicago 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, stress reaction is left shin. Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah. So they have no Sano. Buxton has obviously been a lot better.
Mauer's having a good year.
Is he?
Him.
I could not have told you that.
It's 383 on base, 414 slugging.
Man.
No, it's fine.
Is Joe Mauer Hall of Famer?
No.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know. I mean, like, some of these, like, really, you know, I guess it depends on your peak versus longevity, and maybe he just, like, keeps doing this long enough to get to, like, he's 34. If he just keeps doing something like this and gets to, like, 2,500, 2,600 hits, maybe he like combines his peak with enough just like hanging around being okay to get there. Because he was like,
it would have been one thing if he were still catching too.
Well, yeah, but he's been a like below average first baseman for like 4 years now.
Yeah, his black ink, his all the Hall of Fame stats that you can find at the bottom of his BR page, all are slightly below the average Hall of Famer. So
his first 5,000 plate appearances, which is a lot. He had 323, 405, 468 as like an elite catcher.
Yeah, that's
we'll talk about this in like 10 years.
It just randomly popped in my head, and
it's a good question. It's a better question than I thought.
Oh, by the way, while we were talking, I looked up the 14-game winning streak for Cleveland. They have improved the run differential by 71.
Wow.
That includes a 3-game series against the Royals where they outscored them 20-0. So it was more Royals than White Sox with this streak. That was a 12-0, 4-0, 4-0 when the Royals were on the midst of their streak where they went like 45 innings without scoring a run or whatever. 45 innings without scoring a run in August/September, and they're still only 2.5 games out of a playoff spot.
Amazing. And as we speak, I guess the Yankees are bludgeoning the Orioles, so I'm gonna double down on my Royals Rays prediction.
I think so you're saying the Yankees are falling out when you said Royals Rays?
Look, I said logically.
Oh, okay.
What I think should happen, I think it should be Yankees Angels. But because I'm picking that, it's gonna be Royals Twins. Because I said that, you know, like, because that's what I want the least.
Yeah.
That's what I want the least to happen, so that's what will happen.
Royals Twins would be a nightmare. I wouldn't watch that game. I wouldn't want to watch that game.
No.
I think the Orioles are going to make it. Just at, like you said, they're getting bludgeoned 7-0. That's just the team that always, last couple of years, they always seem to sneak in.
Well, here's my thing with the Rays, though, is that people are always like, well, you know, the last years, well, Picota likes them too much. Which has proven to be true the last couple of years. And I was like, they're like not very good. And it's like, okay, well, you know what? Look at the other teams they're going against. And they have like the rotation, you know, they got good pitchers. They got Archer. They got Alex Cobb. They got like Blake Snell looks like he's figuring it out. Odorizzi's pretty good. They have Feria pitched great. Like Andrisi's been like a pretty good back end guy. Like the rotation's like the best of all of these teams. Maybe I overvalue that. Their bullpen's solid. They got a bunch of dudes who like hit a bunch of dingers. So like, I don't know why can't this team be like the freaking Twins and Royals and this other garbage that's floating around contention? Why not?
For real, I think from a talent perspective, top to bottom roster, they might be the fifth best team in the American League. You know, behind the three division leaders and the Yankees.
I think
you could make that argument.
Texas post Darvish sort of thing.
Yeah, Texas post Darvish. I mean, when I went and saw the Rangers and White Sox in Arlington, the Rangers were starting guys like Brett Nicholas and Drew Robinson. So I don't know how much. I mean, they're kind of going stars and scrubs approach at this point.
If they don't trade away Tim Beckham, they're like probably a couple.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So
I like the Rays. I'd like it if the Rays made the playoffs. I don't have anything against that org.
Yeah, I forgive them for their cowbells 10 years ago.
Yeah. And Grant Balfour and Orlando Cabrera screaming at each other.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt that way about Orlando Cabrera, too, so that was fine. Balfour and I were united on that one.
Yes. So we're at 118. I think we should – do you have anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up?
Nah. I mean, you and I could go on for hours, but –
we could.
But yeah, so, you know,
all right.
Go Angels, go Rays.
All right, we'll talk to everyone later.